Today I'm pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Tim Ball. Dr. Ball was a professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg, where he taught for 25 years. He is currently chairman of the Natural Resources Stewardship Project and is an environmental consultant who was featured in the British documentary The Great Global Warming Swindle. Dr. Ball, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity again, James.
No problem. I'd like to start off today by talking about some of the scientific issues involved in climate change, since that's what it's ultimately about. Could you just summarize your position on the theory of man-made global warming for the listeners who may not have heard our first interview?
Okay, the idea of climate change is being presented as if it's something new, and it isn't. Climate changes all of the time. And my career has spanned two climate changes, and it looks like it's going to span a third, if I can hang on here. That is that when I started out, global cooling was the threat, and now global warming is the threat, and we're heading into cooling again. So the concept of climate change being presented as something new. The science of it, the science has been being studied for a long time. And it's interesting because a lot of people are quite confused. Climate was a new word and that to the public, and that's interesting in itself. The Greeks understood about climate. In fact, the word climate comes from the Greek word klimat for angle, and they were talking about the angle of the sun. So they had a greater understanding than a lot of modern people. And then in the late 19th century and into the 20th century, meteorology took over. And it became dominant because of weather forecasting in the First World War. And meteorology is, in fact, a subset of climate. Meteorology is actually studies of physics of the atmosphere. Climate is the study of weather patterns and how they change over time. And so there's confusion about that in the scientific community and in the public at large. The idea that the climate changes, as I mentioned, became an issue back in the 1970s when the world was cooling down, had been cooling down since 1940. And it became political at that point. The CIA coined a word climatocracy and did studies on the impact of that climate change on food production and the potential social and political unrest that the U.S. might have to deal with. And then about the mid-80s, it shifted. The science shifted because the focus came upon global warming. And unfortunately, at that point, it was political that through the United Nations agencies, CO2 became the focus. And therefore humans were the cause, first of global warming and now more recently of climate change. In fact, what this has done is focused upon one very, very, very small part of the total the weather and climate system, the CO2, and particularly the human portion of it. And it's ignored the total science of climate change. Of course, climate, to back up a bit, when you stand outside, the weather you experience is white noise. That is, it's the sum total of all the red noises from cosmic radiation in deep space to geothermal heat off the bottom of the ocean. And when you study climate patterns, then it's how all of those variables change through time. And yet the focus has narrowed down scientifically and politically to one very small part of it, and that's a major part of why there's so much confusion about what's happening. And what I was as opposed to the panic about global cooling when I began my career in the 70s to the concept of global warming and now climate change. And in fact, one of the ironies of it that underlies all of this is I'm referred to as a climate change denier, when in fact my whole career has involved trying to educate the people to the fact that climate changes. I'm anything but a denier, but that illustrates how little people understand and how political the issue has become. So the climate changes all the time. It changes naturally to a much greater degree than the public have been educated to understand, because the dominance of our view, Western view of the world, is something called uniformitarianism, that is, that change is gradual over long periods of time. And so what that has done is it's allowed environmental extremists to point to changes and claim that these are unnatural, when in fact they're perfectly natural. And that's the soup and position that we see ourselves in right now. So CO2 isn't a pollutant. CO2 is not causing climate change or global warming. And we need to calm down and get the debate back focused on the proper science.
Okay, there are a number of threads that I'd like to pick up on from what you just said there. Firstly, how about going over that process by which the global cooling hysteria of the 1970s turned into a global warming hysteria in the 1980s?
Well, it stemmed from, as far as I can determine, and I've been doing quite a lot of research on this, the Limits to Growth, which was a book published through a group called the Club of Rome, and this started in the 70s, and Paul Ehrlich, with his population, overpopulation of the world, scare tactics. And out of that grew an idea in the mind of somebody by the name of Maurice Strong that led to him making a statement that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? Now, I'm not on your program. We're not trying to defend industry. It's created some problems, but it's also done a lot of good. But Strong decided that, say, the industrialized nations were falling apart morally, and it was because of industry and growth and so on, which is ironic because, of course, he made all his money in industry. But he, from that statement, he got involved with the United Nations and was a principal organizer of the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, out of which came two very influential events. One was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that was created in association with the World Meteorological Organization, another UN agency. And then the second thing that Strong was very influential in, by the way, the IPCC, what it did was it narrowed the focus upon human causes of climate change. And when you look at their mandate, they don't look at natural variability or causes of climate change. Their mandate tells them to only look at human causes, and most people don't know that. But it was done deliberately to keep that focus. And then, Strong then took the whole concept globally and into the environmental field with the 1992 conference in Rio, which he chaired, and he was the major organizer of that. And as I said, that took it global and it took it political. And so we're suffering the consequences of that now. The question then becomes, well, how does this determine what's going on today? And the question I posed in my earlier comment about why the focus on CO2 when it's such a very, very minor part of the whole system? And the answer, I think, is that if you're going to shut down the industrialized nations, if you imagine them as an engine, which in effect they are, driven by fossil fuels, if you shut off the fuel to the engines, you can shut the engine down. But if you did that socially and politically, the public would scream immediately. And we see that with the fuel prices going up, there's immediate reaction. But if you can stop an engine by plugging the exhaust, and if you show that the exhaust of the industrial engine, a lot of which is CO2, is going to cause catastrophic climate change, then you can convince people to totally change the way they're operating things, and you shut down the industrialized nations. So that's why CO2 became the focus. And as I say, that brings us up to the situation that we're in today.
And you've mentioned in our last interview and this interview that you feel that we're heading into an age of actual global cooling yet again. What are some of the key scientific indicators for those cooling trends?
Well, that's a very good point. And one of the things that the public have noticed, not all of them, but a lot of them noticing, and the media especially, that they've stopped talking about global warming. The focus now is climate change, and forced on them because while CO2 continues to increase in the atmosphere, and I have some difficulties with the measures of that, but nonetheless, let's accept that, that at the same time, the global temperature has declined slightly. Since 1998, there's been a slight decline in global temperatures, and that appears to be certainly from the mechanisms that will continue. And so you have this problem that Huxley talked about a century ago of the great tragedy of science is a lovely hypothesis destroyed by an ugly fact. What they've done is then shift the goalposts from global warming to climate change, which then allows them to point at anything, any event, say, oh, it's due to human impact in CO2. So we get this bizarre situation we're in now where it's hotter, it's due to CO2 and global warming, it's colder, it's wetter, it's drier. They point at everything. And what they've effectively done now, Gore does this in his movie, unfortunately, with great skill, is they're showing natural events and telling you they're unnatural, which of course means that they can't be wrong because tomorrow there'll be more natural events. The IPCC that I mentioned earlier, with its focus upon human causes, leave out in their computer models, leave out major mechanisms of known causes of climate change. One of those, for example, are what are called the Milankovitch effect. This is changes in the orbit of the Earth around the sun, changes in the tilt of the Earth, which every school student knows are the causes of the seasons and temperature variability on a seasonal basis. Those are left out. They argue that they're on such a long time scale that they're not significant in the shorter picture, but that's simply incorrect, especially when you're looking at forecasts for 50 and 100 years. And that mechanism shows a continued or a shift towards a cooling trend. But the major one they've left out is that it's been known for 150 years at least that the relationship between solar activity manifest by sunspots and manifest here on Earth by the aurora borealis and global climate are very direct. In fact, the Aboriginal people of Northern Canada use the aurora to make very, very good weather forecasts. And that connection is left out of the IPCC studies. And yet, as I said, it's a well-known. Now, the difficulty with it was for a long time, and the reason they claim they left it out was because the mechanism wasn't understood. Now we have a very good mechanism. It's called the Svensmark Cosmic Cloud Theory. And as the sunspots vary, the magnetic field of the sun varies, and that affects cosmic radiation coming from space and from the sun. And as the cosmic radiation varies in the lower atmosphere, it causes variation in the amount of low-level cloud. And low-level cloud, of course, then becomes, it's almost like putting a shutter into the greenhouse and therefore controlling the temperature of the greenhouse with that cloud. And the correlations between cosmic radiation and clouds is quite remarkable. So the mechanism is there. Right now, we're in a low of sunspot numbers. We're going from cycle 23 into 24. It is being very slow in starting cycle 24, and we know from the record that goes back to 1610 that when the sunspot numbers are low, the Earth is cooler, and when the sunspot numbers are high, the Earth is warmer. And the solar physicists know that when there's a delay in the onset of the next global or solar cycle, cycle 24, that it is usually, it means a low number of sunspots. So the expectation is a much lower number of sunspots in cycle 24, and then even lower number in cycle 25, which will occur about 2030. And therefore, the anticipation, and most of the Russian climatologists are looking at this and talking about this, and I have much more respect for their work than what's coming out of NASA in particular. And so there's an anticipation of much, much cooler temperatures by the year 2030. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that we're preparing for warming, and yet it's cooling. And for Canada, cooling is a much greater threat and a problem to us in terms of energy needs and survival and agriculture and everything else.
Well, on that subject of the solar link to climate change, I wanted to bring up a report that came out last summer after we had the chance to talk from the Royal Society in Britain. It was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society A by Mike Lockwood from the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Britain and Klaus Frohlich from the World Radiation Center in Switzerland. And their argument was that the recent data from the last 40 years show that while the sun's output has fallen over the last few decades, temperatures on Earth have risen. And I'd like to read a little bit from that CBC News article, which ran under the headline, "Sun Did Not Cause Recent Climate Change, UK Study." It reads in part, quote, "The power of the sun peaked in 1985, they reported after assessing nearly 40 years of data. Yet the Earth's average temperature has gone up 0.4 degrees steadily over that period, both before and after the peak," end quote. I just wanted to get your idea about that report. What do you say to that report, and what do you think of their data?
I think that I don't know who peer-reviewed it, and this is one of the problems, but it should never have been published. It's just simply nonsense. First of all, it's almost become a rule now with me that the minute I read that it's model output, that they've used models to do this, I just ignore it, because the models simply don't work. So what they've produced there is model-generated arguments. And I've already mentioned to you the two major activities on the sun that are not included in the models. The other problem with the models is you have to ask a question about what are they built on. When you look at the world even today, now we've got satellite coverage which covers the globe, but that's ignored. And the surface stations, 70% of the world is not included, and it's very clear that the surface data, not only in terms of the quality of the sites and the measurement, but in terms of where they're located, and they're being influenced by the urban heat island effect. So the models and that work by those people simply doesn't hold up. Yeah. So in the study, which as I mentioned is a computer model study, they're using this data on increasing global temperature, but those are surface temperatures which are very, very suspect, and not only that, but the people that are producing them are refusing to tell us how they calculated them. And one of the things that's absolutely essential in science is that other scientists are able to reproduce similar results, and in this case we're not. So it makes you very suspicious about what's going on. And an example of that was about a year ago, there was in Gore's movie, he says that 1998 was the warmest year on record, and that the 9 of the 10 warmest years were in the most recent decade. Steve McIntyre, who was the fellow who with McKittrick shot down what's called the hockey stick graph, found the flaws in that, found flaws in how they were calculating the global temperature, and notified NASA, the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, run by James Hansen, by the way, whose hand is all over this stuff. Very quietly, no press release, no announcement, they just very quietly changed the numbers. It was spotted right away by people that are monitoring these things. And what it did was it changed 1998 from being the warmest on record to 1934 being the warmest on record. And it changed from 9 of the 10 warmest years in the most recent decade to 4 of the 10 warmest years being in the 1930s. You can be extremely suspicious about this, and I think everybody should be. I personally don't think these things are accidents. There are too many of them that is deeply troubling to me. But it points to the problem with the numbers on global temperature that they're using and how they're generated and what they really mean. And so when you put all of that together, that the models don't work and the data you're putting into them is very, very questionable, it really, really becomes a meaningless exercise. The other thing with that study, by the way, is that, again, it leaves out two of the major solar causes of climate change that I've mentioned, the orbital or Milankovitch effect, as it's called, and the changes in the sunspot data. But even in the IPCC report, using their model, and they only use one model, and by the way, people don't know that they run the model many times and then use an average result, because each time they run the model, it gives them different results. So they give you an average of the results, which is an amazing thing. But even there, they acknowledged that variation in the heat and light from the sun, what's called the electromagnetic spectrum, explains at least 50% of the temperature variability that they're telling you has occurred. And so when you look at all of those factors, and you're seeing a lot of these articles trying to show that the sun is not the major cause of the climate change, because they've got to keep the focus on the CO2. And so what's happening is, unfortunately, that within science itself, which should be amoral and apolitical, it's become very immoral and very political.
All right. On that note, I'd like to get away from the science itself and into some of the political issues. I'd like to get one issue out of the way. There have been certain well-publicized accusations in the national media over the last week that the Friends of Science has been violating Canadian election laws by running radio ads about government policy during the 2006 federal election. Could you tell us in your own words what the Friends of Science is, what your association with them is, and how would you respond to these recent accusations?
Yeah, about, I've forgotten how many years ago, about eight years ago or something like that, I was contacted by a fellow by the name of Albert Jacobs, a wonderful man. And this is a group of people in Calgary who, as professionals, they're hydrologists, geologists, and specialists in their field, and they were very, very frustrated about the poor science that was going on with regard to climate and climate change and so on, and they wanted to somehow get a way of getting to the public the accurate science, and so I met with them in Calgary and talked to them about the climate and climate change and what was going on, and then advised them on how to set up the group. I had warned them about the personal attacks that would go on, and of course they already were aware of that, because here were professional peoples, and just being from Alberta, the stigma of, oh, that's oil-controlled views and so on. So they already were aware of that. They set up funding then through a neutral party, or as they thought was neutral party, when it was the University of Calgary. And the money went in there, and then, of course, that kept them arm's length from it. They have studiously tried to stay above the politics and have stuck to only the scientific information. And they found that, of course, the attacks on them saying, oh, they were funded by oil money, it was used as part of the attack on me. It turned out that, yes, 20%, according to the president at the time of Friends of Science, that 20% did come from energy companies. But, of course, that wasn't influencing these retired professional people. They weren't getting paid for anything. And certainly it didn't influence me. I'd been saying what I'd been saying for 20 years before I started Friends of Science. But it was picked up on, and of course this idea that somehow if you are receiving even a dollar from an energy company, you have sold your soul, and I mean that's an absolute outrage. And of course there's a double standard with it, because Suzuki Foundation gets money from two oil companies and one other energy company, but somehow that is okay, and the fact that the chair of their board, Hagen, as a public relations company, and most of his clients are alternate energy companies, somehow that's all right and doesn't influence his view. But so there's a huge double standard going on here. And there's been a constant stream of attacks by a thing called the Smogblog, which was set up by Hagen, funded by John Lefebvre, who's now been found guilty of corruption and $15 million of fraud. But they do nothing but attack personally the credibility of the people that are questioning their political views on this issue. And of course, I think people need to ask the question that if they're attacking the person, what's known in philosophy as ad hominem attacks, why aren't they talking about the issues? And of course, the answer is when you start attacking the person, it means that you've lost the intellectual argument. And so Friends of Science, of course, have suffered this from their inception. And through that, it was argued that I was being paid by the oil companies. Friends of Science sponsored a conference when David Anderson came out and said he consulted all the climate experts in Canada on Kyoto. And eight of us flew to Ottawa to say, here's eight climate scientists that were not consulted. And so basically what the minister is saying is not correct. In that case, my travel expenses came from Friends of Science. So they were saying, therefore, because of that and the 20% of oil money they got, therefore, I am paid by the oil companies. I didn't know at the time that they were getting oil money. And if you figure out there's 20% of their money, so that I got $160 of the $800 came from oil money ostensibly. And to suggest that I would sell my scientific soul and integrity for that is an absolute outrage. But this is the kind of specious looking for a wart and turning it into cancer that these people are playing. And Friends of Science more recently, in order to try and get the accurate information about the science of climate and climate change out, decided that an effective way was through the media. They couldn't afford television, as the World Wildlife Fund can, and Gore, of course, gets instant access. So they decided that they could afford some radio ads, 30-second radio ads, and that was all they could afford was 30-second ads. So they put these ads together and put them out on the radio, and they are all about the science. There's not a mention of politics in them at all. And but of course this group have decided that, well, here's another way of attacking them. This is, they're a nonprofit organization, and here they are involving themselves in politics, and therefore the Elections Canada should look at their nonprofit status and so on. When in fact they're doing exactly what they set out to do. That is, look, here's the science. You make up your own mind and about how this is being used politically. They're not telling anybody how to vote, which way to vote, or anything else. But of course, then they find a media person who's very disposed to their particular point of view and is quite happy to carry it to the media. And of course, the media love the gossip. They love the scandal. So that's how this whole story's ended up. To say it's a storm in a teacup is to overrate it enormously. But that's the game that's being played now. And as with so much of this, it diverts from the real issues. It just as focusing on climate change diverts from the real issues of pollution. And dealing with pollution and other issues that we have to deal with.
Well, then to more of the phony issues, let's move on to the new carbon tax that was introduced in the BC provincial budget last week. First, what do you think of the idea of carbon taxes in general?
They're another grab for money. Politicians are always looking for ways to get more funding. In the U.S. and in fact, or the Western world, they're using terrorism and homeland security as a way of taking away people's individual rights and say, oh, we're here to protect you, we're saving you. And the carbon tax is just another money grab. It will not change anything. Just as carbon credits can't change anything, because CO2 is not the problem. And in fact, to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere is the worst thing you can do, because it's absolutely essential to plant life. And so here they're proposing something that in fact is going to be detrimental, and yet they're saying that they're doing it to save the planet and people have got to pay for it. It occurs, of course, because of the effectiveness of the propaganda of the people that are trying to say that the industrialized nations are causing problems. And environmentalism, very important. Yes, an important issue. We need to care about it. But it's been taken over by extremists and is being used to bully people, and particularly the politicians, who don't understand the science. And that's another part of the problem with it. Michael Crichton wrote about the state of fear and the exploitation of people's fears. There's also an exploitation of people's lack of knowledge and understanding, which was part of what Friends of Science were trying to do. And so the politicians, and by the way, what's interesting is off the record, many of them know the science. Many of them understand that the science isn't there, but the environmentalism has become so extreme that if you say, look, hold on a minute, immediately you're identified as not caring about the children, not caring about the planet, supporting these evil oil companies and oil energy companies. So what a lot of the politicians are doing, and we saw it with Kyoto, which they all understood was wouldn't do anything and was going to cost money and jobs, so they put on what I call the cloak of green. They put on appeared to be look like they were being green and environmental, but underneath they knew the realities. And as somebody said, politics is the art of the possible. And so they're practicing the art of the possible. What can we do? But as I said, they also see it as a tax grab. So that combination ends up with these carbon taxes, which will not solve any single thing with regard to the environment. And of course, in the case of British Columbia, I think that what's going on is that the Campbell government is playing this cloak of green game, particularly in BC, which is seen as a very, oh yeah, we're very environmental people out here and so on. And so I think he's also looking for a legacy. It's the Jean Chrétien thing, looking for a legacy at the end to do things that will make them look good in the eyes of the public. The fact is Campbell had a good legacy when he turned a province that was have-not into a have-province, and now, in my opinion, he's going to squander all of that with this absolutely useless tax that will not deal with anything, and in fact is dealing with the wrong problem.
Well, it does seem useless, and it does seem like it's dealing with the wrong problem. And it's interesting you bring up the Michael Crichton book. As you may know, he wrote an essay to accompany that book in which he talked about eugenics and compared that to the latest global warming hysteria, which I think you'll find relates back to the Club of Rome and More is Strong and basically the entire myth of overpopulation. Do you have any comments about the...
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, sorry.
I was just wondering if you have any comments about the way that eugenics in the early part of the 20th century may have developed into the extreme members of the environmentalist movement today.
Well, it's one of the things that it's interested me throughout my career because I've generally been attacked by extremists throughout my career because as a scientist, I'm a skeptic. And I'd try to be a healthy skeptic and ask questions about all numbers and so on. And I wondered what the role of the extremists was. What happens in society is new ideas, new visions, and new ways of looking, and they talk about it as paradigm shifts, come into play. I mean, feminism, for example, was absolutely necessary, changes that needed to be done, still changes that need to be done. But for the majority of people, they look at it and say, yeah, okay, some good stuff, but how far do we go with it? And they have a hard time understanding how far to take these new ideas. Do you throw out everything of the old and adopt all of the new? So what the role of the extremist is to define those limits for the majority. So in feminism, for example, some women started doing extreme and crazy things, and the majority of women said, no, that's going too far. Now we're losing more than we're gaining. And so the extremists had defined the limits. Environmentalism came in as a concept, absolutely essential. I happen to think it was triggered by the picture of the Earth taken by the astronauts in Apollo 8. And that I saw in my in my career changed everything in terms of science and environmental studies and so on, and so environmentalism came in. And where, for example, when I was on chairing a board looking at the Water Rights Act and trying to come up with a management strategy for a drainage basin in Manitoba, water in the Water Act environment wasn't even an issue when it was written. Now, when you write a Water Act, it will be the top of the list as of concerns. So it was essential. But people started to say, well, how far do we go with this? You know, when the spotted owl and stopping huge industries and putting people out of work and so on. And people starting to say, well, hang on, how far do we take this? And the extremists, of course, by going out as extreme as they have and shutting down so much, are defining the limits, and the public are starting to realize that. The politicians realized it with Kyoto. The public are starting to realize it now in terms of the things that they're expected to pay for and the changes in their life they're expected to make, and particularly when they don't achieve anything, and not only that, but divert away from real issues. And so that's the that is the pattern of what has gone on here. So hopefully things will settle down a bit. And of course, nothing will settle the climate issue down more than the continued cooling of the planet, because that, of course, will and is already making people ask questions about what's being said and what's going on.
Absolutely, it will. Speaking of extremists, I don't know if you saw, but our old friend David Suzuki held a press conference yesterday touting a new economic model from a Simon Fraser University economist that says levying a $100 per ton carbon tax at the federal level is actually going to help the economy by allowing them to cut income tax and ridding us of that vile life-sustaining gas known as CO2. What can you tell us about Suzuki's latest flights of fancy?
Well, of course, this is typical of these schemes. You know, you think, well, you're going to pay a carbon tax, so you'll pay less income tax. But that's the same person in the same pockets. You know, I mean, it's so stupid that it's laughable. And people don't mind paying income tax, by the way, even though it was brought in as a temporary measure to pay for a war. And of course, the government then didn't want to give it up. But people don't mind paying the income tax. What they get angry about is how the money is wasted and how it's spent on wrong issues. And of course, that's precisely what Suzuki and this economist is saying. Suzuki, of course, started out, as with the environmental idea, with some good ideas. The problem is he let it become political, and that is so evident in his statements and his things. It's very interesting to go back and look at some of Suzuki's speeches. I was looking at one in 1999 in Seattle, whether he thought that Canadians weren't watching or listening, I don't know, but he was in effect, my opinion, of pandering to his audience. But he was explaining why, when at the top of his career with the maximum amount of research funds coming in, he quit genetics. And he claims that it was because he saw it going into eugenics. He saw genetics and genetic modification being used in the form of eugenics, which he was so afraid of. And should be. And so he quit being a geneticist and went off and became a social and political activist on environmental issues. My argument was, if you don't like the way your discipline is going, you're far better to stay in it and police it and fight within it, as I've tried to do. But Suzuki chose a different route. And of course, it's interesting about to read that speech about what caused him to become a social and political activist, and it was around the eugenics. Ironically, he's ending up, in my opinion, exactly the same thing about the climate issue. And you see the duplicity of the man when he will say, if you start to talk about genetic modification, you say, oh, no, that's my area, that's my specialty. You can't debate that with me, when in fact he hasn't practiced it for over 20 years, but he will quite blithely come out and talk about climate and climate change, and then won't debate the issue with people like myself, who are experts in that field. So these are all just political ploys, and of course, what it's all about with Suzuki and Maurice Strong is about controlling people's views and their political agenda, and introducing their own. H.L. Mencken said 60 years ago, said the urge to save humanity is almost always a false front for the urge to rule, and that's precisely what's going on here.
Indeed, that sounds like an interesting speech from Mr. Suzuki. Do you have any information that could help my listeners track down that speech particularly?
I don't have it right to hand. It was, as I said, it was in a presentation he made to a group in Seattle. Yeah, but anyway, if they Google Suzuki and Google his speeches, and it was made in Seattle in 1999, that should give them enough Google information to track it down.
Okay, excellent. Moving on to a more positive note, I understand that there's a conference coming up in New York that you'll be attending. Can you tell us a little bit about that conference?
Yes, it's a conference being organized by the Heartland Institute without any energy money input, by the way. It's all private funding and foundation funding. And it is a biased conference. I say that, I don't know if the organizers will be happy with me saying that, but I think biases are only a problem if you're not aware of them. The reason I'm saying it in this case it's a good bias is because the skeptic view, the alternative view, has been excluded from not only the conferences, but from the scientists on the IPCC being excluded and so on. There was a similar conference back in 2006 in Stockholm, but it got virtually no play, and they did allow a couple of the people that are not skeptics to attend, and one of them walked out and said, this is a sham. And of course, this is part of the difficulty. Many of us are simply saying, look, let's get a full debate. Let's get all of the facts on the table. So this conference in New York is an attempt to do that. It isn't specifically an attempt to do this, but it does do it, and that is to overcome the argument that the science is settled, the debate is over. And that is absolute rubbish with regard to anything in science, but also to overcome the argument that there's a consensus, the majority of scientists agree, when that is in fact not true. And the consensus numbers they use are primarily from the IPCC of 2,500 members, but less than 300 of them are actually involved in the science part of the IPCC report. And this conference will address those two things, although it's not being done specifically for those reasons. It's being done to allow a public forum for the scientific view and what's wrong with the science that's being used to force massive changes in the global economy and in individual countries' economies and in society in general. And it's a chance to balance the debate and let people make up their own mind, which has not been allowed to happen.
And how can people find out more about that conference if they're interested?
Well, if they Google in the Heartland Institute, it's all one word, Heartland, and it will pop up immediately on their Google, their website. And on the front page of their website is all the information they need about the conference. And hopefully we will have, now this is going to be interesting, the extent to which the media cover it. I suspect that the only way the media will cover it in a meaningful way is if there are protesters outside, and they'll get the bulk of the coverage. But again, that will reflect the huge bias in the mainstream media about this particular topic and issue. And of course, that's another part of the problem. Most of the media don't understand the science and don't understand the issues at all.
That certainly is a problem, and it makes it difficult for people who are interested in following the real science regarding climate change. Are there any websites that you could recommend for my listeners that they could go to get real news about what's happening in climate science?
Yes, I think there's some, and this is one of the valuable things, that the number of people that have been willing to take the flak and take the heat and continue to try and pursue the truth and the science. And as a result of that and the beauty of the Internet, the sites I... obviously going to recommend our own site at nrsp.com, very simple, nrsp.com. The Friends of Science site, which I work on and help them as a technical advisor still, and that's Friends of Science, all one word, .org. And then there is the wonderful site called junkscience.com, and that's again all one word, junkscience.com, and that has marvelous stuff on climate change, graphs and information that's available. They look at other junk science as well, but the climate change is the major focus. And by the way, they're offering a prize for anybody, I think it's $150,000 now, for anybody that can show that CO2 is causing climate change. And in fact, I challenge people even more and say, show me any record where the CO2 changes before the temperature, which is what they're putting into their models. In fact, the record shows temperature always changes before CO2. But anyway, junkscience.com, a good website. A more technical one is CO2science.com. That's all one word, CO2science.com. That's run by Sherwood Idso and his son Craig Idso. They're biologists who've been looking at CO2 and its importance to plants. And then it's that, and it's all its relationship to climate change, a wonderful scientific site. What else can we recommend? On those sites, of course, there are very good links to other websites. Oh, the other for if you want more technical stuff, I would recommend Steve McIntyre's site, Climate Audit. Again, all one word, climateaudit.org, which is looking at the statistics and the manipulation of the statistics and the use of numbers and mathematics. And of course, he's the guy that found the error with the hockey stick. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, the problem with the current global temperatures. And so that's a very, very good site as well. So those are some that I would recommend to your listener.
All right, lots of information there. Dr. Ball, thank you again for joining me today. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And thank you for joining us on the Corbett Report.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for keeping an open mind and allowing all sides of the issue so the public can draw their own conclusions. I really appreciate that.